True Crime Cast.
Hello, and welcome back to True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie here with John. We're happy to have you back. We appreciate all the downloads, and we appreciate you coming back to hear about another case. Today we're going to be covering a case that, at least from my childhood, was one of the biggest cases that I can remember. I was actually talking to the guy who handles our podcast uploads, and I mentioned to him the case we're doing, and he said, "Wow, I've never heard of that name," and that was shocking to me because it was such a big deal when I was a kid. I remember O.J. Simpson, I remember the Menendez brothers, and I remember this case. So John, why don't you go ahead and get us rolling?
All right, Jamie. So tonight we're going to talk about the JonBenet Ramsey case. And like you said before, man, this is a case that if you grew up in the 80s and 90s, you're going to know this name. You're going to know JonBenet Ramsey. Now, I have to be honest, Jamie, I didn't know much about the details of this case until about a year ago when I got started in this true crime journey of mine. So it was pretty interesting to get to know this case, so I wanted to share our take with the listeners. First, I want to get started by sharing the people involved in this case, kind of go through the family, give some backstory, and then we'll really dig into this case. So, JonBenet Ramsey was a six-year-old girl who was murdered in her home. She was the daughter of John Bennett Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey. Just a little bit about both of those folks. John Bennett Ramsey was a very successful businessman. They were from the Atlanta, Georgia area. However, they moved to Boulder, Colorado, where this story takes place. John Bennett was the president of a company called Access Graphics. Now, this company was a very successful business dealing with computers, and later that company became a part of a pretty successful business that I'm sure everybody has heard of, Lockheed Martin. So, I mean, this family had a ton of money. They were very successful in this business. Patsy Ramsey was famous in her day for being a former beauty queen in West Virginia. In 1977, she won Miss West Virginia. And she got JonBenet, the six-year-old at the time, involved in several beauty pageants. And that's kind of how everybody knows this case. If you pull up a picture of JonBenet, you're going to see, you know, the glamour shots and stuff from her beauty queen days and all the pageants that she was involved in as a kid. She also, JonBenet, had an older brother. He was 3 years older than her, and his name is Burke. On the night of December 25th into December 26th of 1996, JonBenet was murdered in her home. So, Jamie, why don't you give us some more details about that case?
Yeah, what I remember from being a child was really just that she was a beauty queen that was murdered in her home, and really everything else around the case was a mystery. And honestly, it remained a mystery to me until, like you mentioned, I started looking into this case just out of interest in true crime and learned a lot in preparing for this episode. So to let you all know the facts of what happened in her home when she was found murdered, it actually took place on Christmas Day of 1996. The family had been out to a party with several friends. They came home shortly before 9 p.m., and JonBenet was put to bed shortly thereafter. They said she was in bed by 9:30, and her brother Burke stayed up to a little later to play with his dad. He was a little older, so he stayed up a little later before he was put to bed. And then shortly before 6 a.m., Patsy, who was JonBenet's mom, finds a ransom note on the kitchen stairway, which led to the discovery that JonBenet was missing. She found the note. She said she read the first few lines. Then she went and saw that JonBenet was not in her room. She started screaming for her husband. In the note, which we'll get into a little more in a minute, it specifically said, "Do not contact authorities." She immediately did so. The police were called at 5:52 a.m., and two police officers were there within 5 minutes, which is an outstanding response time. But she also called family and friends to come over to let them know what was going on, to ask for help. The police arrived. They looked around the home. They saw no signs of forcible entry. They thought this was a kidnapping, so they definitely locked down her room for evidence to see what had happened. But otherwise, they didn't lock down the home. They immediately set up shop to await the ransom call to respond to the notes. And they set up the house as kind of their workstation to respond to this kidnapping and to help to find JonBenet. Lots of friends and family came over. Their minister came over. They had victim advocates come over to the home. Police Detective Linda Arndt arrived at the house around 8 a.m., and she was really in charge of the investigation early on. And she was there to await a phone call from the kidnappers to find out what the next step should be to bring JonBenet home safely. But then there was never a phone call. Before we go on with the rest of the investigation, let's talk more about the ransom note, John.
So we're going to read the entire ransom note here in just a few minutes, but I wanted to talk about some specifics of it. So one of the most interesting parts of this ransom note is the specific demands. They asked for $118,000. Now, that's kind of random, and in my opinion, that's a really low number to throw at a family who had their hands on much more money at that time. But $118,000 is almost the exact amount that Mr. JonBenet Ramsey received in a form of a bonus at Christmas time from his company. So pretty odd, in my opinion, that these people who allegedly were kidnapping JonBenet, or JonBenet rather, would ask for the exact amount. So kind of fishy.
It's been said that he had made over $1 billion up to that point. Obviously didn't have that kind of money, but they had homes in several different states. I think it could have been assumed that they had millions of dollars.
Right.
So to ask for that low of amount is very interesting, and the specific amount would lead you to believe that somebody had inside information about that bonus check, whether it was inside his family, inside his company. Super fishy.
Yeah. Yep. It just seems weird to me that they, if they knew that specific of an amount, they would know that he had access to way more money. So it seems logical in my mind that a person would have asked for at least $1 million. But no, they asked for $118,000. Probably the most interesting piece other than that to me is the fact that this note was not prepared in advance. So it appears as if it's definitely was written inside the home. Whether it was before or after the murder, we don't know that. But it was written from a notebook found within the kitchen that belonged to Patsy. So not only did they write this note in the kitchen, but they actually took the time to write a practice note. They actually found a practice note in the house as well, where the writer took time, didn't like where he was going with it, threw it away, started all over.
Or she didn't know what she was doing.
We'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, I mean, this is Patsy's notebook written inside the home and with an amount of money that would have probably been on their minds in recent days, because that's a significant amount of money just to get at one time, right? So there's been some talk about the length of this ransom note. There's a full picture of it online that you can look at if you want to. In my opinion, Jamie, it's not that long of a ransom note. I thought we could go ahead and just read the whole thing so that our listeners could know what it says and, you know, exactly.
Yeah, I had always heard it was 2.5 pages long. In my mind, that always seemed really long to me, but now that I've seen it, I think the notebook was a fairly skinny notebook, and those 2.5 pages is really not that much.
Yeah, so the picture that I saw online, it almost looks like the skinny notebooks that you would keep on your refrigerator to almost make a grocery list out of. So the first time I heard about a 2.5-page ransom note, I thought, wow, that is really long, because I was picturing something like a legal pad. That's not at all what we see here. So let's go ahead and read this, and we can talk just a little bit more about it. It says, Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We do respect your business, but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed. And if you want to see her in 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills, and the remaining $18,000 will be in $20 bills. Make sure you bring an adequate size attached to the bank. When you get home, put the money in a brown paper bag. I will call you between 8 and 10 tomorrow to instruct you on the delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you be rested. If we monitor you getting money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money, hence earlier pickup of your daughter. Any deviation from my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do particularly like you, so I advise you not to provoke them. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authority, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned. They are familiar with law enforcement and their tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions, and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny, as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use good Southern common sense of yours. It's up to you now, John. Victory. Signed, SBTC. So, pretty straightforward in my opinion, and, I mean, not as long as people are making it out to be. What are your thoughts when you hear that, Jamie?
It's not as long, but so many things are awkward about it. To claim to be a group of individuals that represents a foreign faction, why would they go after his company and specifically him if they were just mad at America? There were a lot of misspelled words. A lot of the sentences just feel broken. Maybe they're trying to be clever, or trying to sound dumb, or trying not to be clear. But they are very clear and direct with their expectations. Very threatening and very strong. And they make it very personal and continually using John's name.
Right. So I will let you know that this letter was, of course, analyzed, and a three-week study of this letter by a lady named Miss Wong. She felt like this note was written by Patsy. And in particular, she noted that the way that the letter A was written, there was four different varieties of the letter A, and they all matched to the way that Patsy would use the letter A in her writings. So, I don't know how definitive this is, but I wanted to throw it out there that there is an expert who believes this was written by Patsy.
I think there was a lot of talk about, again, the way that she writes her A's, whether she wrote them in cursive or in regular script, and even some analysis of things she wrote before and even afterwards. It seemed that she completely changed the way she wrote her A's after this happened, as opposed to how she wrote them before, which seemed consistent with the letter. So, again, just super fishy, super odd that her handwriting would match it. Now we know that handwriting analysis is not 100% concrete. So it definitely doesn't indicate that she did it. I think what it's usually used for is to exclude people and to say, well, it's definitely not you. But what we can say, there's no way to say it was definitely not Patsy. Does that make sense?
Right. So, Jamie, that was the first thing that was found in the house. Why don't you walk us through the next thing that was found?
Sure. So, like I said earlier, Detective Arndt came over to coordinate the investigation and wait on the ransom call, and that never came. So, around 1 p.m., she asked folks to start looking more around the house, see if there were any other notes, see if there was any other information, see if there was anything that they may have missed or that may give them better clues. Well, there was a room down in the basement off of the den. They looked throughout the house, of course, but when they got down to the basement, there were several rooms down there, and there was one room which John and his friend Fleet White, who was there with them, was looking around with them. Fleet White went into a room. He couldn't find the light switch. It was pitch dark. He didn't see anything. He just came back out. A few moments later, John went into that room and immediately saw the body of his daughter, JonBenet. She was lying there with a white blanket covering her torso. She had duct tape over her mouth, and there was a nylon cord tied around her wrist and also around her neck. Now, when he saw her, he immediately tore the duct tape off and dropped it inside the room, and then he ran upstairs and laid her body down. Detective Arndt moved it into the living room, which was the second time the body was moved, and then after that, the mom actually placed it under the Christmas tree, which again seems weird, but it's hard to say as a parent if you're going through that, what might be going through your head. Another thing of note is that Patsy said that JonBenet was not wearing the clothes that she put her to bed in at 9:30. She was now dressed in leggings and a shirt, as opposed to the pajamas she'd been put to bed in. So she was wearing different clothing. She was obviously dead. She had the nylon around her neck, and she had the duct tape on her mouth. It was untelling how long she had been dead, but they did do an autopsy to determine cause of death. And what did they learn then?
So in the autopsy, they learned several things. Her official cause of death was ruled as a strangulation, and she also had a skull fracture. So asphyxiation by strangulation associated with cranial head trauma as well. Now, Jamie, I've mentioned before on the show that I am a social worker, so of course when I hear about, you know, stuff like this, I wonder if there's been any form of sexual activity, you know, a rape or anything like that. There was no evidence of a conventional rape, although it did appear that some kind of sexual assault did happen. There was no bodily fluids found on JonBenet, but there was evidence that there had been a vaginal injury, and there was also evidence that her vagina had been wiped down with a cloth. So obviously something happened there that shouldn't have. This is pretty gruesome, Jamie, but there was a garrote used in this case. If you're not familiar with that, basically it was a, you know, some kind of loop, like a rope, that was placed around her neck. And then they inserted some kind of stick in that rope and twisted it so that as they twisted it, it would get tighter around her neck. That was placed around her neck and used to strangle her. Part of this was a paintbrush that was from inside the house. There was another part of the paintbrush that was missing, and it hasn't been found at all. It looked like this came from some of Patsy's art supplies that she had in the house, but we don't know the full story of how they got that instrument. This is kind of interesting. It's not necessarily associated with her death, but it does give you some insight into what she was doing right before her death. Inside her stomach, they found a freshly eaten pineapple. And inside the home, there was a bowl of pineapple sitting at the kitchen table. They did some tests on that bowl, and the only prints on that bowl were of herself and Burke. So it looked like at some point after they got home from the party, the two of them helped themselves to some pineapple. Now, from what I understand, the parents did not remember this, so it could be that her and Burke got up at some point in the night and went downstairs and got a midnight snack. So that's some of the biggest things that we found in the autopsy at this point. Now, we've learned some other stuff later that we'll get into, but for right now, that's the bulk of what we found in the autopsy.
Well, they also found that she'd been hit in the head, likely rendered unconscious, and that she was probably unconscious for an hour or so before she died. So if you're looking at the timeline of this, at some point she was hit in the head and knocked out, killed an hour, hour and a half later. At some point during this, the ransom note was written. At some time during the night, she had pineapple. It just seems like a lot happened in the middle of the night while the parents were sleeping. You mentioned that Patsy said they did not have pineapple before bed, and she also thought she would have heard them getting the pineapple themselves. So we'll get to that theory in a minute about how an intruder may have played a part of that.
I want to say one more thing about the autopsy. In some reports that I read, and not in all of them, but in some of them, it reported that she was possibly, her neck showed evidence of a stun gun. So I don't know if there's truth to that, but I will say that it is in some reports that I read. So it appears as if maybe before her head trauma, it could have been that she was incapacitated with a stun gun as well. I didn't put it in my main report because it was inconsistent data, but worth mentioning.
When I looked further into that, I found that they actually tested several different tasers or stun guns, and they could not find any brand where the two points matched up. But what they did find that matched up were the tracks of a train set in that same room. Now, I don't know why somebody would have been jabbing her with the end of a piece of a train track, but that's the only thing we've been able to find that matched up with those marks.
Right. Definitely worth mentioning, but...
Yeah.
So
another weird thing to look at. So early in the investigation, a lot of people, just like in every case, began looking at who were the last people to see her. It was the parents. It was the family. A lot of people started pointing the finger at them. But they did broaden the investigation. By October of 1997, they had over 1,600 people in the index of the case who had been at least a person of interest or someone to consider. Complicating the investigation were the errors made in the initial investigation. They did not quarantine the entire house when the police arrived. They only quarantined her bedroom, whereas the real crime scene was in the basement. The body was moved multiple times and touched by multiple people in rooms where there were a lot of friends and family and ministers and advocates coming in and out of. So the crime scene was so very contaminated. Part of that's that they thought they were dealing with a kidnapping and not a murder. So they tried to approach it in that way and didn't take precautions in case they were wrong. Another piece was that in Boulder, Colorado at that time, they didn't have a lot of technical experts at dealing with crime scene investigation. The parents and Burke were questioned in the days following her murder, but very informally, just kind of, well, where were you guys? What should we look for? What did you see? It was never formal interrogation or questioning, and they really didn't agree to do that for quite some time. A man named Lou Smith, a detective who came out of retirement to help the district attorney's office with this case specifically, presented the case in May of 1998 with the district attorney's office. There were 437 items of evidence, and he concluded that the evidence pointed toward an intruder and away from the Ramsey family. There were people in the police department that were absolutely sure that the Ramseys were guilty. There were people in the police department that were sure they weren't involved. The district attorney's office didn't think they were involved. So there was a lot of animosity between both within the police department, between the police department and the DA's office. And at some point, the governor had to get involved, and he named Michael Kane as a special prosecutor to initiate a grand jury. And we'll talk more about those theories in a minute. But basically, the investigation was really hard to undertake because the physical evidence was all contaminated. One thing to remember is that all the evidence was inside the house. The murder weapons were inside the house. The notepad that the ransom note was written on was inside the house. There were no foreign objects introduced into the scene. Everything that played a role in this murder was already inside of the house. But then all of that was contaminated. If the suspects were in the house, obviously their DNA was over it. So what are the theories that people came up with?
So basically, Jamie, there's two different theories that you can look at. There's the family member theory. So someone inside the family unit was involved in this. Or there's the intruder theory. Now, I will say to your earlier point that all the murder weapons and the ransom note, every piece of evidence that we have is from the home. Now, some people who will buy into the intruder theory will say, well, that's good practice because you don't want to bring something from the outside in because it would be easier to track those particular items to an intruder, right? So let's get started first on the family member theory. So Boulder police initially concentrated almost exclusively on John and Patsy as the people who perpetrated this crime. According to McGrayer, he was a retired profiler with the FBI. He said that statistically, it is a 12-to-1 probability that a family member or a caregiver is involved in the death of a child. So right off the bat, the statistics are not in favor of John and Patsy. I mean, according to statistics that we have, it would seem almost likely that they were the ones who killed JonBenet. From the police perspective, they just didn't see evidence of anything that would lead you to believe an intruder did this. They didn't see forced entry. They did see sign of a ransom note that was written from within the house on paper that was owned by Patsy. They did not find the Ramseys to be cooperative in helping them solve this case. They were requested to interview several times, and they refused to do any kind of formal interviews. They did this, in their words, they were reluctant to give an interview because they were afraid that if they were to do the interview, the focus would be solely on them and they wouldn't be looking for an intruder. So they just refused to do it. Now, in my opinion, Jamie, you can chime in, that almost makes them look more guilty to me. If you refuse to do an interview and refuse to get your point of view heard, it doesn't really look that great to me.
I know this is the John Bailey move, but if I put myself in their shoes, I would think that I would want to be as cooperative as possible. Mm-hmm. I would want them to have every piece of information that I had. Maybe there's something that I know that I hadn't thought of yet that could be helpful in finding my daughter's killer. So right. I would give them every piece of information that I had, and I would want to clear myself quickly so that they could focus on other people. If it's obviously focusing on me, I would think I would want to clear that up as quickly as possible so they could get the focus where it needed to be. But I'm not in their shoes, and I may feel differently if I were in that place.
I like how you did that. And I agree completely with you that if, you know, God forbid this were to happen to my family, I'm going to do everything in my efforts to assist the law enforcement. And if they want to do an interview with me, by golly, let's do an interview. I mean, you got to do everything you can to help find what happened in this case. So there are a few different theories on what might have happened inside the home that night regarding to the family. One theory that we found was that Patsy struck JonBenet in a fit of rage after some kind of bedwetting episode. I don't know. You know, Jamie, over the years, there has been so many different conspiracy theories and so many different people saying so many different things that probably just aren't true. So I don't know if her home had evidence of a bedwetting episode and that Patsy would react in this manner to such a thing. What we do know is that Burke, who was interviewed three times after this in months to pass, he would say that his mom would never hurt the kids. They never got a spanking for any kind of discipline. So his words were that she would never lay a finger on him, let alone kill your child. So at least according to Burke, this does not sound like something that Patsy would have done in a fit of rage. It just didn't seem characteristic of her personality. The interviews that Burke participated in did not raise many concerns for investigators. They brought in a child psychiatrist to interview Burke, and that their comments was that, from all accounts, this was a healthy, caring family with positive, caring family relationships. So a lot of the stuff that Burke gave them early on would actually help clear the family. It didn't seem like there was anything strange going on within the home. Something else that I found interesting regarding the family theory was they brought in a former FBI profiler, John E. Douglas, to assist the Ramseys' lawyer in the case in January of 1997. This man looked at the evidence and kind of gave his knowledge to the case and talked about that when a family member was involved with the murder of their child, they would generally construe the events so that another person would find the body. So I guess in your mind, you don't want to appear to have knowledge of where the victim was, so you would set up the investigation to where somebody else would find the child. Well, in this case, John indeed found JonBenet. So doesn't really fit with the expertise of this former FBI profiler. In this case, like I said, John found the body and a friend followed him into the basement. This expert also said that when a family member is guilty of killing a child, it's pretty common for them to place the body in a manner that would be considered protective. So he said that oftentimes he would find children wrapped in a blanket, or, you know, their whole body would be covered almost as a way of, you know, showing some care, even though you've done this awful thing. In this case, there was a blanket on her, but it only covered her torso. So in his opinion, it just didn't match his years of experience in that her body wasn't positioned in a way that he would have thought it would be. And there wasn't a blanket involved in the way that it thought. And also that he found the body himself instead of letting someone else find the body. So in his opinion, now I will say this, he was hired by the family. So of course he might have been paid pretty well to have these opinions. I don't know that for sure, but he does have expertise with the FBI. So I generally tend to hold his opinions to some kind of higher standard because of his profession, but that's what he laid out, and that's what we have. So that kind of wraps up the family member theory. So, Jamie, walk us through the other intruder theories that have come up over the years.
I have a few more questions about the family theory. Of course, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
So the expert says that usually the family doesn't find the bodies. However, the father did find the body, but he found the body in a pitch black room where his friend had just gone in and didn't see. You would have to think that that's a little odd. Another piece was that the mother found the ransom note, and when she called the police, she said, "I only read the first few lines and I called immediately." But then she went on to tell them that it was signed off by whatever letters those were, SBTC. So she had familiarity with the end of the letter, even though she said she had only read the beginning of the letter. It seemed like they knew more than they should have in the discovery pieces there. We also know that fibers from the mother's jacket was found on the duct tape that was left in the basement room. Now, again, they lived in the house, their DNA's everywhere, but she was not near that duct tape, at least on the inside. It was found on the inside, the sticky part of the duct tape that was on her mouth. As far as we know, she wasn't around that duct tape. So that's a piece that has never been cleared up for me. And then the last piece is more about Burke. I know you're a little worried to talk about Burke. He has sued people and won millions of dollars, which we do not have.
Burke, I'm going to go ahead and lay it out there for you. If you want to sue us, we are in debt $70 at this point to this podcast. There's nothing.
You can have a microphone. Yeah. So there were several books in their house that were about how to deal with a sexually aggressive child. Several books. So you have to think the parents are dealing with something there. He did have records with a counselor that the family never agreed to release. I know the FBI or the police had him evaluated, but there were other records that were never released. It seems like one of their kids was dealing with acting out sexually. There was also a dictionary in the den, and the page was turned and actually folded up and pointing at the word incest, which is weird, and that could randomly happen, except we have all these other books about being a sexually aggressive child. So there is the theory out there that maybe he was trying to be sexually aggressive with his little sister. She threatened to tell on him, and maybe he was the one that injured her and killed her.
Right, and I'm going to take it a step further and say that if that is true, and if there was, you know, the sexually acting out between siblings, that's something that just doesn't happen on a normal family basis. You know, that children don't do those things unless they are taught that in some form or fashion. So I think there's a lot you could speculate on in this case. I'm not comfortable doing that without knowing a lot more facts about the family's history, but certainly is at least intriguing as to why those books were there. Patsy was not a school teacher. She was not a child psychiatrist. She was not in any way a child developmental expert. So it would seem as if the reason those books are there is because there was a problem they were trying to deal with. It would make sense for it to be within their own household. I don't know if I would buy as many books to help research for a family friend or something like that. So, again, could be a conspiracy theory, could be a legit situation that needs further looking into.
It's another theory, so right. I just wanted to throw it out there so our listeners can be very informed. They also need to be informed about the intruder evidence, because that does exist. While there's a lot of weird stuff happening with the family, there are things, as the instructor or the investigator that we mentioned earlier, Lou Schmidt, after the DA had decided not to prosecute on the potential indictment from his earlier findings, when he actually thought the family was not involved, he started working with the family to help find who may have done it and find more about the intruder. So these are a lot of things that he came up with. One piece is that there was an unidentified boot print left in the basement in the room where her body was found. Doesn't seem to be anybody in the family that had that boot print. There was one of the investigators who had a similar boot, but the tread was a little more worn. They say that Burke did have a pair of boots like that, but I think they would know the difference between a 9-year-old's boot and an adult male's boot, you would think. There was a broken window in the basement, which some people have theorized that John, who apparently left his keys different places and had to break in their house often, had broken that window and climbed in. But I would think they have enough money where if he broke a window, he would pay to have that fixed. So there was a broken window in the basement. And there was a suitcase there that looked like somebody may have stepped down onto it. There was even a theory that the intruder had planned to put her inside the suitcase and pull it out the window, but the window opening was too small. So there was a suitcase there where they could have stepped down onto it or used that to climb back out of the window. Some early suspects, they had a neighbor named Bill McReynolds who had played Santa Claus and had been around their home. Their family housekeeper had a key and access to the house. Her name was Linda Hoffman Pugh. And there was a man named Michael Helgoth who had died from suicide shortly after her death that was looked into. There were hundreds of DNA tests performed to try and match, or like I said earlier, exclude people. But really no results came of that to narrow it down to people that may have committed this crime. They tried to do enough tests to exclude the investigators that were around the case. Most of the people who were at the party that they went to earlier that evening, a lot of the family and friends and ministers and victim advocates that were in the house that day, that's a lot of DNA to sort through. It was determined there were a lot of burglaries in the neighborhood, and just a few months before the murder, there were over 100 burglaries in that neighborhood. You would think they lived in a really rich neighborhood, so they would have security systems, which the Ramseys did have a security system that had been disabled because John had to break in so often, so that's an interesting piece there. There were 38 registered sex offenders living within a 2-mile radius, which makes me shiver thinking about that around my home. And it was later determined that there very well may have been some unlocked windows, maybe even an unlocked door in the house. John did say that he went around and checked, but, I mean, I don't have a basement in my house. But even when I check all the doors, I usually assume that I've checked the windows before. I don't check every single window, and I would think you wouldn't go to the basement and check every window before you went to bed. Lou Schmidt fully believed that an intruder came through that basement window and that they planned to use that suitcase there, and he found some DNA that many believe to shed new light on the case, even in the last 15 or so years. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so for years that was all we had. However, in December of 2003, some forensic investigators extracted enough material from a mixed blood sample found on JonBenet's underwear to establish a DNA profile. So in 2003, that DNA, it was said that it belonged to one unknown male. They put it in the CODIS system, which we've talked about on other episodes. It's a database that contains almost 2 million people, DNA profiles, but the sample didn't get a hit. So, you know, it looked promising, but what it did do was it was an unknown male profile DNA match. So it definitely excluded John Bennett, Patsy, and Burke. So I'm sure the family loved to see that, even though they didn't have an identified match at the time. That was, for years, that's all we had. However, in October of 2016, there was some new analysis that could be ran. They got enough markers from two sets of her, from her underwear and a shirt, and they identified two unknown male DNA markers. I want to take a minute before I go on with that to say that I listened to another podcast about these evidence that we just heard about, and they did a test on a pack of brand new underwear, and they found male DNA from the factory of this you know, the plant that produced these underwear. So in 2003, to have the one unknown male marker, it's really not outside the realm of possibilities that that could have been anybody. I mean, this was a forensic nightmare at their house anyway, but it's likely that if these were newer clothes that she had on, that it could have been from somebody from the manufacturer's point of view. Now, the test, though, in 2016 had results from both, from two sets, from her underwear and from a shirt. So it would seem logical that somebody had definitely touched both of these articles. So you can't, in good logic, say that this was somebody other than somebody who had touched her in the home.
So you're saying that the same DNA was found on the underwear and on the shirt. So
correct.
This, from the same person.
Right. Okay. So there's no way that you could conclude anything other than it was somebody who touched JonBenet. Now, in 2016, in light of the new DNA evidence, the Boulder County District Attorney, Mary Lacey, gave a letter to John Ramsey. And I won't read the whole letter, but basically the letter will summarize the case in saying that she apologizes for her family being under such scrutiny for the last 20 so years, that they should have been cleared earlier on. So she offers a public apology for the family theory, basically, and says that the new evidence clears them. So now, as of October 2016, because of this evidence, the Ramsey family is no longer being looked at as a possibility of murdering their daughter.
It should be noted that not everyone buys the DNA results. A former investigator of the Boulder County District Attorney's Office, a guy named Gordon Coombs, stated that, quote, "We all shed DNA all the time within our skin cells. It can be deposited anywhere at any time for various reasons, reasons that are benign. To clear somebody just on the presence of touch DNA, especially when you have a situation where the crime scene wasn't secure at the beginning, really is a stretch," unquote. So the DA's office did clear them. They're no longer being investigated at all in this case, at least publicly. I guess there could be private investigators looking into it, but I don't know who would hire them, since the family is the one that usually hires the extra investigators. But this DNA evidence is new, and it's something that we didn't have in 1997, 1998, to look into the case, and it does point toward an intruder for sure.
So, Jamie, you know, we have really just started to scratch the surface of this case. There's 20 years worth of conspiracy theories, and if you want to look into those, Google it, because we're not going to talk about all those today.
My favorite conspiracy theory is that she wasn't really dead, but she's actually Katy Perry. That's a fun one to read about.
Yeah. I don't think that True Crime Cast is going to take that stance, but it is worth reading about online. So, Jamie, I guess in closing, what are your statements that you would want to make, or what are your theories on this case?
Yeah, this is a tough one. Like I said, I remember hearing about it as a kid, and there was just so much mystery around it, but everybody was pointing fingers at the parents. So it's really hard for me to break away from that, especially when we look at all the odd things that happened. Just a few hours after he discovered the body, John was planning a business trip to leave in a couple days, to leave town. Their behavior was so odd, which, honestly, if something happened to my child, I would imagine I would behave very oddly for a long time. So I hate to hold that against folks, but everything is so weird about the way things went down. The parents were in the same clothes when the police arrived that they were in the night before, even though they said they went to bed about 11 o'clock. I feel like they are still most likely involved. I don't know which of the theories I would go with. I don't know if their brother was involved or not. But I feel like they at least know more than they would let on. I don't know. I appreciate all the intruder evidence. I feel like there were so many other people in the house that most of that's unreliable. But I feel like the parents, if I were to guess, I would say that they at least knew more about what happened than they have revealed to anybody publicly or to the police.
Right. So you're not the only one who feels this way. Obviously, there's a multitude of people who would completely agree with you. Just recently, CBS released a documentary that would show all the different ways that Burke could have committed this crime. They did several tests. It's kind of interesting if you want to check that out. But it's possible. It's always possible that they had something to do with this. I'm going to disagree. I'm going to throw out there that I would believe that this was an intruder case. You know, I don't disagree with you. The family was not acting in a manner in which I think I would have acted if this happened to one of my children. But at the same time, when you own a successful business like John Bennett Ramsey owned, it puts a marker, it puts a target on your back. And there are plenty of crazy people in this world who could have saw JonBenet at a pageant, or at least just knew about this family because of the size of his successful business, and in a way to exploit this family and get money, perhaps they did break into the house that night. You know, John Ramsey admitted that he did not use the security system that night, that there were doors and windows open to the house. So, and this was a huge house. So who's to say that an intruder didn't make their way into the house while the Ramseys were out earlier that night at a party? The evidence is there to suggest that somebody went in and out of that window that night. Now, whether that suitcase was there all along or whether it was planted there to make it look staged, I don't know, but it's there, and there's a mark on the wall and on the floor that obviously came from outside the home. Now, I can't say that with all certainty because the ransom note is super fishy. We have an expert who says that this was written by Patsy. It was written inside the home. I think if I were going to break in someone's home and steal their child, I would want to get in and out as fast as I could. So to think that I would sit there, write a note in their house, and do a practice note at the same time, I don't know. I don't buy all that. But with the new evidence that we have from 2016, with the touch DNA on two separate articles of clothing, it's really hard in my mind to say that the family did this, because the DNA is there and there's a lot of other evidence there as well. Like I said before, the ransom note still just kind of gets me. Like, why would you not have prepared that beforehand?
Some have theorized that it was a ransom kidnapping gone wrong. Right. Others believe that they came in and killed her and wrote the ransom note just to throw the police off of their trail. I don't know which side of that you would fall on. But obviously it did completely compromise the investigation when police initially looked at this as a kidnapping instead of a murder. So if that was their goal of writing a note, then it definitely worked.
I guess my closing statements would be similar to what they are every week, that I just hope at some point the truth is known about this case and that justice is served for whoever did this, whether it's someone within the family or somebody outside of the family. I hope that one day we learn what really happened to JonBenet, and that that person or people get what they deserve. There has been, we didn't talk about it in depth, but there has been people who have claimed that they have done this crime. There in, I think it was in Thailand in 2006, a man came forward claiming that he had killed JonBenet. Now, he only talked about to the police things that he would have heard from media sources. So he was quickly cleared from the case and kind of, I guess, construed as crazy. So people have popped up over time to say they have done it, but so far we don't have any solid leads that I'm aware of.
Yeah, and unfortunately, just like a couple of other cases we've covered, I feel like it may be so far removed that we may never know. And that's just super unfortunate for everyone that did and does love JonBenet and wants to know the truth.
So hopefully you've enjoyed this podcast. It's pretty hard to talk about a child being murdered, but you know, like Jamie said at the beginning of this, it was a household name growing up. Everybody knew JonBenet. So it was interesting to me that Jamie talked to a guy who had never heard the name JonBenet. So if you have never heard about this case, we hope that you found this informative. Leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. Again, we have a Twitter page at True Crime Cast. We have a Facebook page as well. We'd love to reach out to you guys. We'd love for you to follow us and follow along with us. We appreciate all of your likes and comments. Keep them coming.
We would love to have your feedback. If there are things you'd like us to do differently, let us know that. We're very open to feedback and changing the format of the way we do this, and we're also open to other cases. This was a case suggested to us by a listener, and we've got another one coming up in a couple weeks we're going to tackle that we haven't heard on any other podcast, so that's going to be very interesting. But send us some feedback, like us, share us, review us, and we'll be back next week.
See you guys.